The BBC presents My Word. And here to introduce the programme and the panel is Jack Longland.
My Word is a word game played by people whose business is words, and this programme comes to you from the Commonwealth Institute. And those taking part are Anne Scott James, Dillis Powell, Frank Muir, and Dennis Norton. Round one tries to test their respective vocabularies. 2 marks if they get the meaning of these words right. Beginning with Dillis Powell. Dillis, what is a dobbin? D-O-B-B-I-N.
Well, it's a character in Vanity Fair.
Yes, it is, but that's not the one I want.
No?
A dobbin.
A dobbin. Well, it's a horse.
Yes.
Oh, it's a very, very stable horse for children, in that case.
Mm-hmm.
A child's
I'll give you
horse.
2 marks. It isn't, no. It's a draft horse, which is a horse which draws things like ploughs and carts, or farm horse. And it's a diminutive, or not a diminutive, of Robert. Pet name for Robert. Dennis Norton, what is an I-I? A-Y-E, repeated. I-I.
I-I is Roman for two. It's a murmur of agreement, or else it's a type of shallot, as in I that shallot.
It's the animal, not the vegetable.
No, I don't think I can keep this up indefinitely. I don't know. It's a naval expression of obedience.
Yes, it's that too, I agree. But not, that wouldn't be an I. That's why I was very careful to use the article first.
I
don't think you're going to get me this time.
Yeah.
I'm not surprised, because it's a squirrel-like animal about the size of a cat, which is found only in Madagascar.
I was just about to say that.
Anne Scott James, the meaning of the verb to hocus, H-O-C-U-S, to hocus.
Well, it's half a hocus-pocus.
Yes. Roughly.
To hoax.
Yes, to hoax is good enough.
Swindle. Cheat.
Yes, to hoax or to take in, that's the primary meaning. It's also been used to describe the way in which you stupefy somebody with liquor or drugs or drug them. But your meaning is all right. 2 marks. Frank Muir, what is a leotard? L-E-O-T-A-R-D.
Leotard? Well, the name suggests that it's a lion who's rolled in pitch. Actually, as we all know, it's part of a ballet dancer's, I think, rehearsal costume. It's an attractively close-fitting part, separate from the tights.
Yes.
I think it goes down slightly beyond where the tights start. There's a kind of overlapping area, and the leotard takes care of difficulties north.
That's a very accurate description, Frank. You get your 2 marks. A ballet dancer's close-fitting, long-sleeved upper garment worn over or with the tights as a practice costume. Well, before we begin round two, I give each team a quotation for them to write down. And I want the 2 women members of the team to study those quotations, because at the end of the program I shall ask them where the quotations come from. So, Dillis Powell and Frank Muir, your quotation is ta-ra-ra-boom-dee. And Anne Scott James and Dennis Norton, yours is should old acquaintance be forgot. And then at the end of the program I shall ask Dennis and Frank to give me their idea as to how these came to be said or written.
Son.
Well, round two is about legends and myths. For 2 marks, Dillis Powell, can you give me the answer to this one? One of the 12 labors of Hercules was the cleansing of the Augean stables. How did he accomplish this?
Well, being a rather strong and powerful character, he diverted a river through it.
Mm-hmm.
And it washed it out.
What were the Augean stables?
Well, they were stables which housed a lot of dobbins.
Dobbins are not, in fact, mentioned, but they might have been there. I wouldn't exclude them.
Cattle.
Yes, there were cattle. The stables of Augeas housed 3,000 of these, 3,000 oxen, and their stalls weren't cleared out or cleaned out for 30 years, which is quite a long time.
Poo.
You can imagine what happened. Hercules diverted the rivers, Alpheus and Peneus, through the stables and cleaned them out in one day. The king then bilked him, didn't give him his reward, and there was a war, and he killed the king and his sons, and thereupon founded the Olympic Games, which I all think is rather a nice touch. 2 marks. Dennis Norton, what or who was Hippocrene? H-I-P-P-O-C-R-E-N-E, Hippocrene.
Sounds like a kind of brilliantine for horses. I can remember there's a bit in Ode to a Nightingale, something about a beaker filled with the warms, full of the warm south, the true and blushful Hippocrene with beaded bubbles. It's the most marvellous drink commercial ever. With beaded bubbles winking at the brim and purple-stained mouth.
Yes, fair enough. I don't think it's going to help
you. So it's
you,
some kind of a drink.
Yes?
Magic drinking water from the river.
You can drink it and drive a chariot.
That's just it.
Half a mark for trying. Hippocrene was the fountain or spring on Mount Helicon, and it was sacred to the Muses and to Apollo, and became, in the end, thought of as a source of poetic inspiration. That's why you get your half mark. But according to the legend, it was produced by the famous winged horse, Pegasus, who stamped his foot on this particular spot, and the spring gushed out. Hippocrene. Anne Scott James, who was it who murdered his brother because he laughed at the city walls that he'd just built? And what did he do to provide the menfolk of his new city with female companionship, because his city was filled with refugees and adventurers and so on, and they were very short of female company?
Well, now wait a moment. Romulus must have built the wall.
Yes.
And Remus must have murdered him.
No, no.
Remus laughed.
Yes.
And Romulus murdered Remus, but the city was still named after Romulus.
That's right. And what did they do about the shortage of female company?
Didn't laugh at that.
Yeah. An enormous number of paintings illustrate this.
Yes.
Well, Denny seems to think that they raped the Sabine women.
You're absolutely right. I get your two marks. This is all right.
On the wire.
Not fair.
They fell for the Sabine women and carried them off and took them to Rome and founded that rather tough race which endured for so long and pestered us at school.
That's it. That's absolutely right. Romulus, on the Capitoline Hill, or the Palatine, I can't remember which, Capitoline, I think, was building walls in order to make his city safe. And Remus, instead of helping, was sitting and laughing, and then finally jumped over the wall to show how inefficient it was as a protection. So Romulus hit him and killed him. But later on, because they were short of wives, he organized this snatching or rape of the Sabine women, and as Anne quite rightly says, Rome never looked back after that. Now, Frank Muir, what was the end of the story of Pyramus and Thisbe, who'd been forbidden by their parents to marry? And I don't want the bottom Midsummer Night's Dream version.
Tragic history of Pyramus and Thisbe.
Yes.
Concerned a wall.
Yes.
Well, that's in the bottom. And
yes, it's there too.
And they spoke to each other through chink, through a knoll in the wall. And thereafter, the love story is rather Romeo and Juliet, isn't it?
A little.
It's the tragic.
Yes, it is.
It's a tragic thing because there's a lion in it, also in Shakespeare. And one of them, Pyramus and whoever was the chap, Pyramus and Thisbe. The lion scared. She arrived first, and the lion scared her, and she dropped her mantle. And he came and thinking. Well, the lion dropped blood on the mantle, and he came and seeing, thought she'd been devoured by the lion, but she actually hadn't. She'd scarpered, and he thought she'd been eaten. So he did himself in. And the stage is littered with bodies. And the actual answer to your question is the curtain falls.
Yes, that's a very vivid description of the legend. And Frank is quite right. It's extremely like the story of Romeo and Juliet, because here were two families who hated each other, and the two lovers, Babylonian lovers, Pyramus and Thisbe, could only talk to each other through the hole in the wall, and they planned to meet away from that under a mulberry tree, and there Thisbe saw a lion, was terrified, dropped her veil or mantle, and the lion had just been eating a cow or an ox, and therefore the mantle got all bloodied. Pyramus comes upon it, kills himself because he thinks Thisbe is dead, and Thisbe comes back and kills herself too. But the last bit of the story, it all happened under a mulberry tree, and the blood ran into the roots of the mulberry tree, and forever afterwards, mulberries, which up till that point had been entirely white, were stained purple with their blood. The next round's about verse and poetry, and in this round I give each member of each team a quotation and ask them to complete it with the next line or two. 2 marks if they can complete the quotation, and 2 more for saying where it comes from. Beginning with Dilys Power. Oh, what can ail thee, knight at arms, alone and palely loitering?
While the sedge is withered by the lake, and no birds sing.
Yes.
It's by Keats.
And the title?
La Belle Dame sans Merci.
Yes, you get your 4 marks. Just to get it quite accurate, what can ail the knight at arms, alone and palely loitering? The sedge is withered from the lake, and no birds sing. Keats, La Belle Dame sans Merci. Dennis Norden. There was racing and chasing on Cannaby Lee, but the lost bride of Netherby ne'er did they see.
I would say it's some kind of a ballad.
Yes.
Walter Scott.
Yes.
Oh, now, wait a minute. Walter Scott ballad. Give me a Walter Scott ballad.
All I can think of is Marmion.
Yes. Go on thinking about Marmion.
That's all right. No, stay.
The bride rapidly removed from the scene.
What is young Lochinvar?
Yes.
Yes. Oh, young Lochinvar, who came out of the West.
Yes, all right. I'd better not ask you to complete it.
No, you better not.
Dennis?
That. No.
All right, 2 out of 4. This is Sir Walter Scott, the Lochinvar ballad from Marmion, and these are the last lines. There was racing and chasing on Cannaby Lee, but the lost bride of Netherby ne'er did they see, so daring in love and so dauntless in war. Have ye e'er heard of gallant like young Lochinvar? And he quite definitely did pronounce war as war. 2 marks.
Might be young Lochinvar.
No, not if you think of Newcastle. They flattened off the air. Anne Scott James. Few and short were the prayers we said, and we spoke not a word of sorrow.
It's, not a sound was heard, not a funeral.
Yes.
The burial of Sir John Moore at Corunna.
Yes, good. Author, can you do? Rather obscure.
Wolf.
Yes,
Wolf.
Well done. Can you finish the quotation?
Not this
few, few and short were the prayers we said, and we spoke not a word of sorrow.
Yeah, happy day tomorrow.
Tomorrow.
It's just hopeless. Let's hope for better luck tomorrow.
That's yours, roughly what it is.
Chas Wolfe.
3 would be rather generous, Mark, but I'll give it you. Charles Wolfe, the burial of Sir John Moore at Corunna. Few and short were the prayers we said, and we spoke not a word of sorrow, but we steadfastly gazed on the face that was dead, and we bitterly thought of the morrow. They were retreating, and that's why they had to do it all so quietly. Frank Muir. Keep the home fires burning while your hearts are yearning.
Ballad. First World War.
Yes.
Written by Ivan Novello. Music by Ivan Novello.
Yes, that's better.
Keep the home fires burning. Something indescribably sad about this song to me, everyone. The singing of it doesn't help. While our hearts keep yearning, though the lands are far away, they dream of home.
Absolutely right.
The
dark cloud shine.
Yes, well, no, yes. Turn the dark cloud inside out till the boys come home. And the words were by Mrs. Lena Gilbert Ford, based on a theme suggested by Ivor Novello, who did, as Frank rightly said, write the music. Well, now we come to the last round and go back to those quotations I gave the two teams earlier in the programme. For 2 marks, Lillis Powell, can you give me the origin of your quotation, Tarara Bumdie?
It's a song.
Yes.
A Victorian song, I
yes,
think.
Yes, it is. By a chap called Henry Sayers. 2 marks. Now, Anne Scott-James, will you give me the origin of your quotation, which was, should old acquaintance be forgotten? I can't pronounce the old properly.
Well, it's from Old Lang Syne.
Syne. Syne. You mustn't say Syne. We get letters from Scotland. They,
Robert
they
Burns.
Cross the border in their thousands if you say Syne. We did. We said it once before on the program.
Yes, we did.
Did we?
Yes,
did
yes and they marched. Down the M1 with their
battle on the border.
Sporrans full of porridge, yeah.
It comes from Old Lang Syne.
Syne.
By
yeah,
Robert Burns.
Absolutely right, and 2 marks. Well, now I shall ask Frank and Dennis to give me their explanation of how these quotations came into being, and on this occasion, the marks will go to whichever unlikely explanation receives the longer amount of applause from the audience here in the theatre. So, back to Frank Muir and his quotation, Tarara Bum Die.
What I Know About Dogs, an essay by F. Muir. Dogs are animals, rather like horses. They're quadrupeds, that is, they have 4 rupeds on which they walk. They're rather like horses, not all that much like horses, because they're smaller. Except if you get a very large dog next to a very small horse. It is possible, it's difficult to distinguish between them. If you find yourself in this predicament, the best thing is to wait until they're both moving towards you, then shout, whoa! And the one that doesn't stop is the dog. Unless the dog's name is Woe. In which case, it isn't a scientific test. Or unless the horse is deaf, it also wouldn't work. Dogs are usually kindly animals. They will eat out of your hand, or your leg, or the seat of postman's trousers. But normally, they are very gentle beasts. Shakespeare was a great namer of dogs, and some of the rather indeterminate names of dogs come from the works of the bard of Avon. The name Prince, of course, comes from Hamlet. Was he originally a Great Dane? Down Prince, you know, from Ophelia. And also, of course, in Macbeth, the dog which misbehaved himself in the castle, and you remember Lady Macbeth saying, out, out, damned spot. There are all sorts of types of dog. There is the Chow, which is a large, rather hairy dog, with eyes rather like raisins, and a mauve tongue, which you can recognize because it's the same mauve as that wine gum which, when you come to it, you put your thumb over it and stop handing them round. These are very popular in Italy, and the puppies are called Chow Chow Bambinos. There is also, in India, there is a large dog which the Indians train to jump up and down on the laundry, which is being washed in the river on flat stones. And the dogs actually do the hard work of the Indian laundry. Unfortunately, your laundry doesn't always come back. These are called Doberman Pinschers. Going down to the smaller dogs, one has the little tiny lap dogs, like the little pom-pom, the little furry white thing, rather like a sheepskin glove turned inside out. But the smallest dog of all is the Chihuahua, which is a naked Mexican dog about the size of a large rat. And funnily enough, this dog is the most popular of all today, because all it eats is a teaspoonful of food, and it requires very little exercise, and it can fit into the tiniest flat, and is the most popular of all after all these centuries of dogs. And that is why there is nowadays will you all join in with this? There is a Chihuahua boom today.
I can just see Frank Muir's nice wife reading that rude telegram from the Canine Defense League after that story. Well, now back to Dennis Norton. If you remember, his quotation was, "Should old acquaintance be forgot?"
It started when my secretary came into my office and said, "There's a man to see you." And I said, "Who is he?" And she said, "He says he's the man from Auntie." And it turned out that... It turned out she was absolutely correct. He was a public relations chap called McGillivray. And he came in and he said, "My dear fellow," he said, "I think I have hit on one of the greatest commercial propositions of our time. Why don't we commercialize aunts?" He went on to enlighten me. He said, "If you remember," he said, "for the retail trader, Mother's Day and Father's Day have been the greatest fillip to business since the invention of Christmas." He said, "Now, why can't we do the same thing for aunts?" He said, "It could revolutionize the bath salts business, the chiffon scarf profession, the half dozen embroidered hankies industry." So I said, "Well, where do I come into this?" He said, "We have got to make, first of all, the British buying public aunt conscious." And I said, "Well, from what I've seen of the British buying public, half of them already aren't." He said, "You've got..." You haven't quite understood. He said, "We are onto a scheme here." He said, "Auntie's Day could make Mother's Day look like Lent." He said, "Because if you think about it, people have only got one mother, but everybody has got dozens of aunts. So you can imagine this in terms of turnover." I began to warm at this. I said, "Well, what part can I play?" He said, "We need communicators such as, if you'll pardon the expression, yourself." He said, "We need to bring the word aunt into the forefront of the public consciousness." I said, "How?" He said, "Slogans. Buy a present for your aunt today." He said, "Songs." So I said, "Well, what kind of songs?" He said, "Well, you adapt existing songs." He said, "Oh, my beloved auntie, we are in love with you, my aunt and I." Now my eyes began to glow. I said, "You know what you could do as well? You could start a new vogue of aunt jokes. Remember, like elephant jokes?" You could have aunt jokes such as, "Which aunt has got a sore finger?" So he said, "Which aunt has got a sore finger?" I said, "Antiseptic." And he caught on to it immediately, you see. He said, "Which aunt is expecting a baby?" I said, "Which aunt is expecting a baby?" He said, "Antenatal." You see? I said, "Yes, or it could be anticipating, couldn't it?" He said, "I like your thinking, boy." He said, "This could be the start of something, what's the word I'm looking for?" I said, "Big." He said, "Yes." And that's how it started. Well, as you know, Aunt's Day now is history. But I tell you the strange thing about this project, that
the more I worked on it, the less the commercial side of it interested me. What I felt I was doing was I was doing something beneficial to these funny old ladies. Because aunts are funny, you know. There isn't a family that hasn't got a strange aunt somewhere. And yet here I was, getting them their own day in the calendar. And this warmed me. It was sort of art for aunt's sake, it became eventually. And after all, there is a kind of a justice in it. If mothers have a day and fathers have a day, should all the quaint aunts be forgot?
The only decent thing Dennis can do now is to go off and start that campaign in real earnest tomorrow. And by your verdict, Dennis Norden wins the contest of the two stories, and that brings us to a final score in which, nevertheless, Dillis Powell and Frank Muir win the contest as a whole by 4 marks, and this also brings to an end this edition of My Word.
In My Word, you heard Dillis Powell, Anne Scott James, Frank Muir, and Dennis Norden, introduced by Jack Longland. The program was devised by Tony Schreien and Edward J. Mason, and presented by the BBC.